I'm Mark Labberton, president of Fuller Theological Seminary. Welcome to Conversing. It's my great pleasure today to welcome Pete Wehner, the Vice President and Senior Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C. He's a contributing opinion editor for the New York Times and a contributing editor for the Atlantic Magazine. He's written for many other publications and appeared frequently on television in various roles as a commentator for MSNBC and CNN and Fox News and CBS and PBS and C-SPAN and all the other perhaps stations or corporations that we might consider. He is someone who's also occupied in an earlier stage of his life direct involvement in three different presidential administrations. He served in the Reagan and the George H.W. Bush administrations prior to becoming the deputy director of speechwriting for President George W. Bush. And it was in 2002 that he was asked to head the Office of Strategic Initiatives, where he generated policy ideas and reached out to all kinds of different public intellectuals, published op-eds and essays, and provided counsel on many different domestic and international issues. He's had a rich publishing history in books as well. His most recent one that came out in June 2019, it's entitled The Death of Politics, How to Heal Our Frayed Republic After Trump. Pete, welcome. I'm so glad that we have this opportunity for this conversation.
Thanks so much. It's great to be with you, Mark. You're someone I've admired for a long, long time, so I'm really looking forward to the conversation with you.
Well, as you and I both know, we share some commonality in our friendships, and we share some commonality in our heritage, both having spent our days in the North Pacific Northwest. And it has been with really great curiosity and interest and respect that I have followed your work and appreciate very much the time that we've had together personally, as well as the writing that you've done. So for those who would like to hear a little bit more about your personal narrative, how did this unfold that a person could end up having such an extraordinary and rich political and also intellectual life and writing vocation? Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. I know. I'm happy to. I mean, the short answer is that the stars aligned right, and I was very fortunate. But to give you a little bit of the history, I was born in Dallas, but grew up in Washington State, a city called Richland, which is on the east side of the state, and went to University of Washington, where I majored in political science. I always had an interest in politics almost as long as I can remember, Mark. I had these conversations with my parents. We had a cabin in the Cascade Mountains. So we went there almost every weekend from the spring into the fall. And I remember pretty vividly the conversations I would have with my parents. We would listen to the news at the top of the hour. And then I would just ask them questions about whatever was driving the news. I remember at one point there was a conflict between Israel and the Arab world, and asking what was behind that, what was the antipathy based on. The Vietnam War was going on, the tail end, and then after it had ended, questions about that, Richard Nixon, Henry Kissinger. So those issues always fascinated me when I was in high school. Social studies was my favorite class. I was conservative, not because I'd really thought through political theory particularly carefully, but really mostly because my parents were center-right. My teachers were liberal, and we had debates, but I enjoyed them. I learned from them. So that interest was there. And then when I went to University of Washington, because I was political science, it's not the most marketable major in the world, I did internships, and those were really important to my career trajectory. I did an internship when I was a junior in the Washington State Senate for a fellow named Dick Hempstead, who was actually a longtime friend of Slade Gordon. And then when I was a senior, I did an internship that brought me out to D.C. at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And that was really a key break for me. I had assumed I'd do the internship and then go back to Seattle and from then, I really didn't know what I was going to do. I guess I assumed I'd go to law school, not because I wanted to practice law, but because I thought I might need to be credentialed. But it turned out that I got a series of jobs when I was out here. So real fortunate or providential, but things seemed to fall into place. And then my big career break, I guess, in terms of government service is that I became a speechwriter for William Bennett when he was Secretary of Education for Ronald Reagan. And I went over there with Bill in January of 1987. And I was frankly intimidated, worried. When I went over, I called my colleagues at Ethics and Public Policy Center, where I was actually at that time, and said, look, if I flame out here, if this blows up, will you all have me back?
Yes.
But it worked out. And I must say, as a young man, it was good to have actually been working at the Department of Education at that time with Bill. He had done his PhD in political philosophy. Bill Kristol was his chief of staff. There were a whole number of people who were extremely well educated and took ideas seriously and seemed to me to be in public life for the right reasons.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think that was a formative influence on me. The other thing I'll say is that I remember when I was at University of Washington at Sudolo Library, which is the main majestic library on the campus of University of Washington, I used to go there sometimes on Friday and Saturday evenings to show you what my social life consisted of. But I would listen to tapes of John F. Kennedy speeches because I was so taken. Well, some of it was the romance and grace of the Kennedy presidency, at least as it was told by people like Arthur Schlesinger Jr. and Ted Sorensen.
Yes.
But also by the power of the words. I think at a relatively early age, I was someone who fell in love with words and the power of words.
Mm-hmm.
And I began to memorize those speeches quite inadvertently just because I listened to them so much. And I used to think that, boy, wouldn't it be great to have a career where you could be an advisor in the White House? And I ended up there. And as I said, I was really fortunate. It's not like I was, you know, top of the line student at Harvard. I was a reasonably good student at University of Washington. But at key moments, there were people who looked out for me, cared for me, advocated on my behalf, and things unfolded in a good way.
Well, it's really an amazing journey. And both the variety and the depth of your engagement is part of what you've been able to bring to so many of the things you've done, and obviously to the writing that you've been doing most recently, but we'll come to that in a second. Now, catch up another strand that was, I think, unfolding in part during the time that you were at the University of Washington, which has to do with the intersection of all of these political issues that you were considering, but also an emerging understanding and embrace of the Christian faith, as I understand it. Can you sort of fill that in?
Yeah, sure. That's basically right. You know, I didn't grow up in a Christian home. I really don't have any memory when I was growing up of going to church or talking about Christianity. Both my parents were deists. I mean, they believed that God existed, but were not practicing Christians. For reasons that I'm not exactly clear on, right around my junior year, between my junior and senior year, I began to explore Christianity, and I don't know what catalyzed that. And it's a journey I began with my best friend, a fellow named Brad Shannon, who I'm still in touch with. Brad lives in Florida now. And my sister is 5 years older than I am. She'd gone to University of Washington, and she was interning at Westside Church in Richland. And when she came home that summer, Patty was a person who I admired a great deal and was a very intelligent person. And I would just pepper her with questions. I remember writing down on my dad's work notepad, you know, question after question after question about faith. And she was very important, very good, very thoughtful in how she helped me work through that. She didn't consider herself, you know, the Bible answer woman, but we had really good conversations. And she ended up connecting me with a fellow named Carl Kopic. And Carl is a pastor at Westside to this day, but Carl started a Bible study with Brad and me. We actually, our first book that I went through was Romans. I'm not sure I'd recommend that to people who aren't familiar with Christianity. It's kind of heavy going, but it seemed to work for us. So that was the beginning of my Christian pilgrimage. Faith, honestly, Mark, did not come easily to me. It never really has. And I remember telling Patty, even years after, or some period of time after, I would have considered myself a person of the Christian faith, saying, Patty, this is like sand in the gears.
Mm-hmm.
It just didn't really come easily. A lot of times it created questions. There were questions in my mind about the depth of my faith. I remember when I would read Paul, I was sort of intimidated by what I read because he described such intimacy with Jesus And I remember telling Patty, there's no way I can ever enter into that. How do you fall in love with a person you've never met before, you've never seen? And yet I had the sense from Paul that he was describing a depth of a relationship that really went beyond the limits of words. And I'll tell you, Steve, our mutual friend Steve Hayner was important to me. When I went to University of Washington, I attended University Presbyterian Church, and Steve was the youth minister. He was running the inn at that time. And I didn't know Steve before I got there, but I admired him very much as I was going to the inn on all sorts of levels, on a human level, on an intellectual level. And there was a part of Steve that seemed to me to be very inviting to people. And I still remember I was having at the time questions and confusions about human sexuality that I had not talked to anybody about. And it turned out in retrospect, they really weren't that significant of questions, but because I hadn't ventilated them, I haven't talked to anybody about them, they became larger than in reality they were. And I remember walking to Steve's office, was on a Tuesday afternoon, to talk to him about those issues. And I almost turned around halfway there, but I went there, and it was a really, really important time and a bonding time. And that really began what to me was a very special relationship with Steve. And so I learned a lot from him, of course, over the years as well. And I'll tell you one other thing, which was, and this is when I had gotten to D.C., so this would have been in the 1980s. And again, for reasons that it's not exactly clear to me, I came to an understanding of the centrality of the cross, which in some ways, of course, to Christians sounds obvious because for every Christian, the cross is central. But I mean it in this respect. Once I focused in on that, and that, just as a side note, was really central to my intellectual journey. For me, I had to try and pin down whether the resurrection happened or not. Was it a historical event? And I researched it enough that, to my satisfaction, it was a historical event. In fact, I actually wrote a paper in English 172 on the case for and against the resurrection, which if you can do that at University of Washington, more power to you. But I was able to pull it off. So I had settled in that that was, in fact, a historic event, and for me, a kind of history-changing event as well. But the other thing that it did to me is I came to the realization that that act at that moment was the central act in human history to understand God's love for us and how he viewed us. And what that did to me is it insulated the character of God from these questions that I had. That is, prior to that, when I had a lot of these intellectual questions, I think it shook a little bit my confidence in God. And when I came to understand the centrality of the cross and I came to view human life, human existence through that prism, and to say that is the definitional act and attitude of God toward us, those questions became somewhat more abstract and less central. So that was important to me. And, you know, Bible studies, I've been involved in Bible studies pretty much my entire life. So the, being, you know, in a community with other believers is really important. And then just being in touch with people like you and pastors and theologians, columns that I've written, I will often reach out, as you know, to people like you and others, asking questions and asking for insights into how to understand what the Christian faith is really about.
Well, what strikes me about what you've just given us is a sort of picture of what I think I would describe as just a richer and richer kaleidoscope of resources that had to do with political things and political science in particular and political philosophy, but also accompanying that, then this really greater and greater network of people and conversations that you had been invited into or were about to be invited into, and then this much richer picture of the character of the Christian faith that is not about a kind of private salvation only, but a sense of God's activity for the renewal and recreation of the world, which is really what is at the core of the cross and the resurrection. So all of that means then you land in D.C. first in this internship, but then you get invited into these additional positions. How much did all of that for you existentially converge with what was also the emerging political speech, certainly during the Reagan era and going on from there, as you track it in part in your book, The Death of Politics, the connection between religion and particularly conservative politics and conservative religion in America? Do you want to trace a bit of that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I would disaggregate them. The convergence of faith and politics, to me, was a reasonably natural one.
Yes.
And the reason that I say that is, I think, partly because of the way my own theology developed, which is this notion that God is an active God, and the incarnation itself shows that he cared about life in this world, that he was not disinterested or dispassionate or removed from events, and that the Christian faith should touch all aspects of our lives. Now, I'm the first person to say that it touches all aspects of my life in very imperfect ways. And mostly I see things through the natural self rather than the Christian self. But at least as a theory or as a philosophy or as a theology, I've always believed, the way I've understood the incarnation and the Christian story and the arc of Scripture, that we shouldn't be involved in life in this world, even as we're citizens of another kingdom. And trying to get that balance is pretty tricky. And I must say, and we can go into this in more detail if you'd like, but I'd say for the most part, Christians have not walked that balance beam very well. So the other thing that I have to say on this first aspect of your question is, I have always believed that politics is finally and fundamentally about justice. That's not all that politics is about. I understand that the dark side and the downside, I've been around it long enough. And certainly there are imperfect people that are involved in politics like there are in any profession. But I believe at the outset, and I believe to this day, that politics matters because there are enormous human consequences to political actions. Now, not all the time, and most of politics is fairly mundane and prosaic, but politics can also be about and involve great moral moments and great moral issues, issues of tremendous moral and ethical gravity. And so I've always had a rather high view of what politics is supposed to be about. So there were, I think in that sense, there was a natural connection between, or in convergence between, faith and politics. And my view was and remains that politics should be subordinate to faith as a person of the Christian faith, that we should develop a biblical ethic and try, as imperfect as we are, to construct our politics around that, which has to do with justice and the moral good and grace and many other things. In terms of the question as it relates to conservatives in the 1980s and how they did it, I was always wary from the outset of how I saw it playing out. For your listeners, that would involve in the late 70s and early 80s, the Moral Majority and Jerry Falwell Sr. and Pat Robertson. And their involvement in politics came after a long withdrawal from politics.
Yes.
After the Scopes Monkey Trial and much else. But they injected themselves in politics. They did it in a way that I was never really that comfortable with. I thought that their tone and their style was off-putting. I thought their theology was often confused. And I never really looked to them as a model. And in fact, Mike Gerson and I wrote a book in 2010 called City of Man, Religion and Politics in a New Era, where we could critique that moment. And what we said in 2010 is we thought that that movement was about to die and give way to a different manifestation of political involvement. By our lights, a much better one. We were clearly wrong about that, as the Trump era has shown, at least from my perspective. But I felt like that the Christians that were involved in politics were hurting and discrediting the Christian faith by how they were practicing their politics and the signals that they were sending to a watching world.
Well, it's an amazing narrative, and I do want to commend to those who are listening to this both The Death of Politics and The City of Man book that you and Mike Gerson wrote, because in both cases, they are books that are helping, I think, people who care about the same kinds of considerations that you're describing think again about the way this narrative has been understood, what its positives, and but also what its underbelly has often been about. So as you tracked that, you were then having to both acknowledge the rise of that, even as you yourself were trying to live out some kind of more coherent expression of connection between faith and Christian vision with a political reality that was unfolding through various administrations. If we had longer, I would love to actually have you sort of dwell on both Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and George W. Bush, but I don't know that we have time for that narrative, and I would just refer people to what you've written, where I think a lot of this is teased out in some extremely helpful ways. So if people are interested in that narrative and your evaluation of it, that could be really, really helpful. Let's say that rich period shaped you and shaped certainly America. So then how, in your understanding, does the moment when you decide that you're going to write this book with this very provocative title, The Death of Politics, what has happened by that stage, and why is it that you write as you do, I think, so powerfully with such a sense of urgency, both for the political realities of America and for the Christian realities as well?
Yeah, I wrote because I really do think that we're at a precarious and alarming moment in American politics. The title is The Death of Politics. The subtitle is How to Heal Our Frayed Republic After Trump. And so I guess as a Christian, I believe in the resurrection. So I'm not declaring this dead and over.
Yes.
But I just believe that politics is more rancorous. There's greater antipathy, that it's much more of a theatrical show than at any time that I've been involved in politics. And there's a degree of polarization and even hate that's coursing through both, I would say, political parties and both political movements. But I think it's particularly pronounced, frankly, on the American right and in the Republican Party. And I say that as somebody who, as you indicated, has worked in the three previous Republican administrations. So I think reason is being put down as a third or fourth on the concentric circles of what politics is about. There's a tremendous amount of political tribalism, the sense of people being bound to people in their own tribe. Actually, if you look at the social science data, what animates people most is not affection and loyalty to their own tribe as much as hate and antipathy for people in the other tribe, which is dangerous. And I feel like we're in a post-truth moment where reality is being pushed aside and politics and political debate increasingly is being detached from truth. And I think that the person who personifies that most and is driving that most is Donald Trump. I don't think it's exclusive to him. I think all of these movements that are troubling about American politics predate the president, but I think he's accelerated all of them in the wrong way. So I felt like I should write this book because I do care about politics and because I do think that it matters and I think that justice matters. And if we don't get it right, there are going to be some tremendous human costs to that. I think that's already been the case, but that it can get a lot worse. But I've also tried to provide perspective in the book, to be careful about romanticizing the past, and also to give what I think are some authentic grounds for hope. I don't think that was an affectation, but look, I think we're in a low moment right now, and I think it's going to take a real effort and a struggle to get things right. And I think that the maladies in politics, the pathologies that we see, are a manifestation of maladies and pathologies in the country at large. Mm-hmm. That is, I think politics in a way is a stage in which some of these things are playing out. There's a synergy for sure. I think the political stage is causing provocations and making things worse. But I do think that in a sense, sometimes people want to say, well, politics is broken and the rest of the country is fine. And I actually don't think that. I think our politics is broken because in many ways, I think our country is broken.
I'm Mark Laverton. You're listening to Conversing, a production of Fuller Studio. So for those who haven't yet read the book, Pete, just describe a little bit more specifically what you mean about the death of politics. The politics that you're referring to has what primary definitions at the core that you're then saying it's that politics that I think is either dead or dying?
Yeah, the way I describe politics is probably at a fairly, high altitude. So I don't mean the partisan politics, but I mean politics in terms of a community of people mm-hmm. working together in the realm of public policy and our common life mm-hmm. to try and solve problems. And in the American context, it has to do with certain virtues which are central to politics and are necessary to make it work. And I devote a chapter to the virtues like moderation, compromise, and civility. Our system of checks and balances and separation of powers inherent in that is the notion that compromise is necessary,
right?
And that people need to work together. And beyond that, it's a notion of what binds us together mm-hmm. as a nation and as people. What are the things that we share in common? What is the good that we want to do? And then politics also has to do with the interaction of human beings. How do they treat one another? What's the nature of debate? How do you pursue truth in a broken and imperfect world? Mm-hmm. So all of those aspects, you know, involve politics. And as I said earlier, there's also this notion of politics as a means to advance justice. I don't think by any means it's the only or even the most important way to advance justice, but mm-hmm. it is a way to do it. And if you lose those elements of what politics is about, if you lose the notion that it's there to try and imperfectly to understand truth and the reality of things, to promote the human good and the common good, to be instrument of justice and to bring about reconciliation and repair, if those things are lost, then a lot is lost for a country, for communities, for individual lives. And that's really what concerns me. I think that a lot of things that are important to the good life, to a good political life, are being stripped away.
Well, when I read the book, I remember being struck by how relatively free I felt you were from a kind of nostalgia that was looking back in your own experience during either the Reagan administration or either of the Bush administrations, and to represent it as though it was a period of idealism. Clearly, it was not. But yet what it does do is give you a kind of fulcrum of contrast between that period and this period. I wonder if you could just tease out a bit more detail about what you see as the contrast. Nobody thinks you're looking back and saying those were the halcyon days, but they were different and they were better. And in your view, I think that's part of what grounds your critique so significantly and importantly. Can you just say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. The first thing I would say is that every previous president from this one, and here I'm including Democrats as well as Republicans, had a certain regard for truth. That didn't mean that sometimes things weren't bent. Some presidents, we know from Lyndon Johnson in Vietnam, lied. But there was a certain belief in having to tell the truth and being held accountable if you didn't tell the truth. Once upon a time, if a president said something that was wrong or demonstrably wrong, that would cause a lot of consternation in the White House. And I know it from my own experiences. You know, we got things wrong, I got things wrong, but they weren't intentional. And when you found out that they were wrong, you tried to correct the record and try and correct the problem. That, I think, is very different. The other thing which is different is that the previous presidents in the modern era, certainly some of them were polarizing, and being polarizing is not per se necessarily wrong. Martin Luther King was polarizing. Reagan was polarizing. Franklin Roosevelt was polarizing. Jesus was polarizing. So I'm always careful when people say that polarization is itself wrong, because it depends on polarization for what ends. If you're polarizing people in the pursuit of justice, that can be justified. But what was different in the past was you did not have a person in the presidency who seemed to take a kind of psychic delight in dividing people and creating antipathy and really turning Americans against each other. Again, sometimes that happened. We certainly had it in the Vietnam War in the late 60s and early 70s. But that was not intentional. That was, in a sense, a byproduct of the policies. I think another thing that's different, and this is particularly true if you talk to people who have been in Congress for many years and historians of Congress, which was the personal relationships across the aisle were deeper and more personal for a whole variety of reasons that doesn't exist now, partly because members of Congress are much more likely to go home to their home districts than spend time together. So that human connection has been lost. And we're also in a time of depolarization. And we know that from all sorts of studies, Pew studies and others. And this is something that's been going on for decades. And that reason for that is complicated. Some of it is the purification of political parties. So, you know, when you and I were young and, you know, we were in the Pacific Northwest, there were figures, well, let's take Oregon, for example, Mark Hatfield and Bob Packwood. They were liberal Republicans. And then you had conservative Democrats. Certainly in the South, you had conservative Democrats, but you have people like Joe Lieberman and to some extent Daniel Patrick Moynihan. And you don't have that anymore. The parties have become much more purified. You have pretty much exclusively Republicans all on the right, Democrats all on the left, and there's very little common ground. Then you've had what what social scientists refer to as the big sort. So people have sorted themselves geographically and in terms of lifestyle. And so there's less connection to people who live a life different than you do. Mm-hmm. And when that happens, it's much easier to criticize other people.
Yes.
And Amy Chua wrote a book called Tribe. It's a very interesting book the last few years. And she wrote about how everyone feels threatened. And there, I think, to a degree that's unusual in my experience, and I think this goes very much to Christians today, evangelical Christians, white evangelical Christians, I think there's a tremendous amount of fear that people have, and it's manifesting itself in politics. And what that fear eventually transmutes into is anger. And so I think that's different. And the last thing I'll say is that there's a degree of dehumanization that is occurring in American politics from the highest levels that we've just never seen before. You know, politics has never been a walk in the park. There have been controversial moments all through American history. Both sides have complicity in it. Both sides have legitimate complaints. But the almost daily dehumanization that is happening now from the Oval Office is deeply troubling. And that has huge ramifications, because I think almost everybody understands intuitively the power that a president has in setting norms or breaking norms and in setting a set of standards and values and expectations. So it's just different than it's been in the past. And I say that as someone who's been involved in plenty of intense debates. Politics is always passionate. You know, you go back to the 1800s, the first contested election in American history between Jefferson and Adams. It was a really ugly and nasty affair. And as I said, the late 60s and early 70s, there was tremendous anger and fierce conflict in this country. But there's something about this moment that's different than the late 60s and early 70s. And I just feel like we need to understand it. And as people of the Christian faith, we need to try and be agents of healing and reconciliation and understanding, even as we stand for justice and the moral good.
Well, it's significant to me that today, when we're recording this conversation, earlier this afternoon in Washington, D.C., there was a swearing in by our Chief Justice of the 100 senators in the U.S. Senate to continue the next stage of the impeachment hearings, and the implications of that remaining yet to see what's going to happen in the trial phase. And I just think that the way that the paradigm has been set is so much a reflection of everything that you've just described, and that at least it suggests to me we are facing a serious impairment of a constitutional system that I think, taken at its best at least, is meant to help a republic understand and critique itself and its leadership in ways that should be very, very occasional, but when they arise, there's an opportunity for that. Whatever one makes of the House hearings and now this trial, there's such a fundamental dissonance for so many people about whether this is an act of pure folly and legal and rational insanity, or whether it's a demonstration of something that is the working out of political actions that are simply being called into account. I mean, just the way that the whole matter is being framed, it feels to me like it carries the weight of the critique that you've just offered. Do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, no, I think that's very elegantly said. I do think that what we're seeing with impeachment and the way that the two parties are dealing with impeachment is a manifestation of these deeper maladies that are happening. You know, I was awfully young at the time, so I don't have a real vivid memory of when Nixon was impeached. But I was alive at the time, and I've certainly studied it enough. And at that time, there was a kind of moral gravity to the moment and a seriousness to the moment. And that's really lacking here. And this just seems to be playing out as just the latest act in a very nasty political drama. And it's hard to watch because some very serious, I think, wrongdoing has happened. But there's almost no ability for the two sides to speak to each other. And that, I think, is a tremendous problem in American life right now, which is that so many of us end up in our own political silos, our own political bubbles. And because of social media and the advent of all sorts of technological advances as it relates to politics and beyond politics, we have this ability to confirm what we already believe. I mean, confirmation bias is as old as human beings, and it's a fundamental part of human nature. And I struggle with it, and you struggle with it. We all do. And that is, it's the notion that we're all susceptible to searching out facts and evidence that confirm what we already believe. And we're also, on the flip side, are very resistant to trying to engage in an intellectually honest way with facts that challenge fundamental worldviews or fundamental views themselves. So that is just part of the human experience. But I've never seen the confirmation bias that we're seeing now. And, you know, the way I've described it, Mark, is for most of my life in politics, if you thought about politics using an analogy of a mountain, people would say, here's the summit that we both agree on, but liberals and conservatives, Republicans and Democrats are going to follow different paths to that summit. Today, I have the feeling that people are talking about two different mountains and two different summits. And people aren't even talking in the same epistemological world, universe.
Yes.
People are making up their own facts, and they are ignoring facts that are inconvenient to them. And it's really dangerous stuff, because if you can't agree, have some kind of conception of reality, of what the nature of reality is, true truth, that makes self-government really, really hard. It makes political debates really, really hard. And it's one of the reasons I think today that the quality of our debates is so low. One of it is just in terms of the intellectual rigor of the debates and the rhetoric of the debates. But we are not even having debates about issues today. It's almost as if politics has become a performative art rather than one that involves governing. I have a very close friend, Yuval Levin, who has a new book coming out this in January called The Time to Build. And Yuval's thesis is quite insightful. And basically what he argues is that institutions, a whole range of institutions, from religious to media to politics, education, and on and on, we used to believe that institutions had a central role in forming us as human beings, forming our character, our dispositions, and our temperament. Today, people view these institutions not as formative, but performative, that is, stages on which they perform. And you can see that actually in the political realm in Congress. You know, it used to be that if you were a freshman, you kept your mouth shut, you were a workhorse, not a show horse. You waited in line, you learned, you took notes, you spent time with others, and you worked your way up the ladder. Today, people come in at sometimes at very young ages, sometimes not. They've had no experience to speak of, and they just begin to use politics as a stage on which to perform. And I think that that change in terms of how we view institutions has had a big effect, and in this particular regard, I think a harmful effect.
Well, certainly many people in the postmodern culture have spoken and written at length about the fact that having given up significant and essential meanings of any particular kind, we're left on a stage with really nothing but language and power. And what you're saying is really just the manifestation of that, right? The thing that becomes particularly toxic from a Christian point of view is that that abandonment of any greater criteria or accountability is seized upon by people of specifically and overtly, if not passionately, named Christian faith, who then want to strip away any sense of reality to which they or anyone else is accountable, except the use of language and power that they choose to exercise. Now, that's not because others aren't also doing the same thing, whether it's on the political left or otherwise, but it's like we've allowed this hollowing out to have not only occurred, but then to be embraced as a virtue in this really bizarre way, which is part of, I think, what then creates the space mentally, emotionally, socially, politically, to start making declarations that have no connectedness to reality or virtue, but really just to the force of language and power.
Yeah, that's beautifully put. That's exactly right. I mean, if you detach political involvement, really any part of your life from concepts of justice and truth and reality. I mean, in the end, it just becomes a power game. The irony, a tragic irony to me, is that for a lot of people of the Christian faith involved in politics, not all by any means, it's a complicated story, but for far too many, politics is kind of the will to power. It's a sort of Nietzschean ethic for people who themselves, if they read Nietzsche or understood him, would be the first in line to criticize him. And yet somehow in the transmission, I guess the transmission felt as broken in a way. Mm-hmm. I had a lunch with a fellow, Ken Stern. This is about, a, I don't know, 2 years ago. And it was lunch with myself and James Forsyth, who's a senior pastor at McLean Presbyterian Church, where I and my family attend. Ken is a person who's agnostic, Jewish, liberal. I met him because his editor had asked me to spend time with him because he was interested in learning about the Republican world and the conservative world. And so I was one of his guides. And so, for example, I said, look, if you want to understand young Christians, don't go to Bob Jones or just Liberty. Try Wheat and see that. Anyway, I developed a nice friendship with Ken, and we were at lunch. And he had told me a story where he had gone down, this was in rural Virginia, and he had spent time at churches there and talked about really liking the people there, actually having some degree of affection for them and a lot of the good works that they were doing. But he said to James and to me, he said, what I don't understand is why Christians in politics don't tell the story of the good works and the examples, in my words, not his, but the grace that is happening. Why is it that they speak and act in a way that is so off-putting and comes across as so judgmental? You actually have a powerful story to tell. Why don't you tell it? And I thought it was a really good question.
Yes,
a mutual friend, Philip Yancey, told the story in his book, What's So Amazing About Grace. When he started that book, he used to ask people in airports and others, when he mentioned the word Christianity or evangelical Christianity, what came to mind? And he said that almost without exception, they were culture war concepts, abortion, homosexuality, and so forth and so on. And he said he never once heard the word grace. Mm-hmm. Now, if you believe, as you and I do, and really as anybody of the Christian faith has to, which is grace is dead center of our theology, if that's in fact the case, and people aren't seeing that, if what they're seeing play out is ungrace, is judgment, is harshness, is resentment, is grievance, something has gone terribly, terribly wrong. And I think the most painful thing for me today when it comes to Christians who are involved in politics is that it is discrediting to the Christian witness, and I think particularly for the younger generation, because there's no Christian distinctive that people see. And that, I think, is so important, and where people of goodwill who are Christians have to think through, how can we conduct ourselves in a way that sends a different message? And, you know, you and Maku Fujimura, when you've talked about culture care instead of culture war, and the entirely different instincts that it means to have a mindset of culture care rather than culture war, to see the world not as a battle zone, but a place of abundant possibility and promise. I think that's an extremely powerful thing. And I think we have to think through with a lot of care and energy how we make that change.
Pete, I think what you've just said summarizes why I think as we close this interview, I just want to say to people that whether you're a person of the political right or political left, and whether you're a Christian or whether you're not, I think that this book, The Death of Politics, How to Feel Our Frayed Republic After Trump, is really a book that I think calls all of us, wherever we are across that spectrum, to a higher self-examination and social examination of the things that are actually going to sustain us personally, as well as a society and culture that has much more health than ill health, which I think is palpably present and palpably felt as a source of deep discouragement for people across the political spectrum. And I just want to thank you, Pete, for this conversation, but also for that book, and hope that people will let it do its germinating work of causing us to all have to ask deeper, longer, greater questions than just to throw up our hands in the midst of whether it's the trial that's about to unfold in the Senate or the latest rhetoric from the White House or from any other part of the political spectrum as well. Where do we understand ourselves to be grounded, and what is it that's going to be life-giving to us, to our neighbors, to society and culture? And that's really where the culture care vision, I think, wants to see us spend much more time and energy. So, Pete Wehner, thank you very, very much for this conversation.
Thanks. I enjoyed it a lot, Mark. Take care.
You've been listening to a production of Fuller Studio. Fuller Studio provides articles, podcasts, videos, and other resources for a deeply formed spiritual life. Subscribe on your favorite podcast app or visit us at fuller.edu/studio.